webcam microphone.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
See, but I have the files. You know, I read this stuff in the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself, how can that be possible
for him? You know, all the characters and the agents of choice and on the internet, professional wrestlers,
and not just Ventura style.
It doesn't matter whether it's hard to change the record as long as it's real.
It doesn't take
hard to get real in this fiction.
Because seriously,
you know what she's always raised to her chest whenever I try to prove out one of those.
No,
it's not.
You expect your government to tell you the truth, you're going to sadly, sadly disappoint
another one of these things.
Dear, dear Lord, what a dirty, dirty old man.
Really now?
Serious.
Is this really?
I want things to be
more hooker, you know, eruptions.
Whatever.
Really?
Allegedly broadcast live from FEMA Region 2. Within the borders of the formerly united and currently occupied states of Amerigo, we bring you the O'Shelly Effect.
It's like, damn sure, no, I'm going to,
you know, we have all these situations. I'd love to know what, why it takes 50 years, you know, for
that's that.
And why does it take 50 years? It is Saturday night. That means, guess what? It's the O'Shelly Effect. But you know what? We're not going to be limited to just Saturday nights very much longer. Starting this week, I'll be on Tuesdays and Thursdays on this network from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. That's Eastern time. I believe it's 5 o'clock out there, out west, Pacific time, something like that. Anyway, check the banner, check the time, check the schedule. You'll see it. So we are expanding. Tonight, I bring back, again, a guest who actually got me a bunch of emails because he was just so fascinating. And, you know, we didn't really get to the meat of the story that I wanted to get to with him. But tonight, we're going to do it, okay? But also, we're going to get a few other things from Mr. John Barber, who is, again, the gentleman who produced the Garrison tapes, who also was the creator of Real People. And just quite honestly, I've said it in a couple of different places, and if I didn't say it on my own radio show, let me just say this. John is the kind of guy who, one way or another throughout my lifetime, has given me the idea that there is a way that media should be and there is a way media is. And the way that John does things, the way that John thinks, the way that John has produced things over the years, from the Garrison tapes to Real People to the many, many projects he's been involved in, I've got to tell you something. He gave me an inspiration to seek to make the media differently. And that is really the key for me with this guy. And I just love to talk to him. John, how are you tonight?
I'm terrific, Chuck. And again, congratulations on expanding to three nights a week. And I must tell you, you'll do really, really well three nights a week, and sometimes the best shows and the best things are said just three times a week, because when I ended up at KNBC in Los Angeles doing film reviews and was a media critic for NBC, I only did it Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I did it three nights a week, so you're going to do terrific, and again, congratulations.
Thanks so much, John. And, you know, everybody has been talking this week about the Bundy Ranch thing. And John is out in that neck of the woods. So, you know, I did sort of want to get his take on it, being that he's a local guy and familiar with the media and all that. In fact, one of your friends is George Knapp, who is, my listeners might know him from Coast to Coast AM. He does the weekends. I don't know exactly what his schedule is, but he's definitely one of the better hosts on that network of shows and that network in general, because they have the podcast and they have all the newsletters and all that, plus the radio show every night. But I like Matt myself. And hey, what else can I say? But, your take on it is something I would love to hear.
First of all, George Knapp is not one of the better hosts on Coast to Coast. He is by far the best host on Coast to Coast. Mostly he does Sunday nights, and sometimes he does Saturday nights. And I'll tell you how independent and how effective a journalist George Knapp is. About 6 years, every November 22nd, as you very well know, George Noory and Alex Jones and all these people somewhere do a show on the assassination of John Kennedy. And I had heard an absolutely dreadful show that George Noory did, in which he had a guest who claimed he knew Garrison in the early 90s, 91, 92, 93. And so, of course, I listened to the show, and the guy turned out to be an absolute liar, because that was about the time that I was making the Garrison tapes. Jim Garrison was on his deathbed, so the only way you could possibly contact Jim was through the family, and only one or two people ever got to see Jim, because he didn't want to meet anybody with him while he was lying on his deathbed. So I sent this email to George Noory explaining that outside of Jim's staff, his family, and the CIA, nobody knew more about Garrison than myself, and he should get the Garrison tapes and let me come on and talk about it. And I absolutely never heard from him again. Everybody for the last 12 years has refused to have me on as a guest, in spite of my credentials. I mean, I've got 5 Emmys. I'm the only one in television who had them for both news and entertainment. I've got a Golden Mike Award for commentaries. But in spite of that, and having had the number one show in the country, groundbreaking show, predicting that I would change the face of television with what I called the entertainment of reality, nobody would have me on to talk about Jim Garrison. So in desperation, I sent an email to George Knapp at Channel 8, and I copied him the note that I had sent to Noory, which was rather scathing, but I got a call within the hour from George. And he said, "I remember you. You used to do all that terrific work on television." I said, "Thank you, George." He said, "Is your documentary that good?" I said, "It's the best thing I've ever done. Even though I'm proud of a lot of the accomplishments of real people and the social changes we made, which we can talk about later if you wish, Chuck. But in any event, the reason I say that, because David Letterman is leaving CBS. And that's sort of akin to the Ford Motor Company saying they're not going to make the Edsel anymore. I mean, you think about David Letterman, 20 years on the air, and what has he contributed except more bread and circuses, distractions from what the Empire is doing. But in any event, I sent him the documentary. He called me back the next day. He said, "I was just going to look a little bit of it last night. And I ended up looking at all of it. We've got to do something about this." He booked me immediately on the Sunday night show and literally saved that documentary from oblivion, because then it got to go up there on my website, John Barber's World. But in any event, I trust George implicitly, because when he started to look into this Bundy case out in Overton, and the reason I mention that it's Overton is because a lot of people are talking about Harry Reid and his son, who are trying to do something in Laughlin, which is 100 miles away and has nothing to do with Overton, but I'll get to that later. And I understand that you have one of your people out on the site there at the Bundy Ranch, and I hope they call in with the latest update. But in any event, it was George's story, Chuck, that brought it to the national attention. And up until that time, like you, you're trying to get information about what's going on. And I recall what Mark Twain said nearly 100 years ago. He said, "If you don't read the newspapers, you're uninformed. And if you do read the newspapers, you're misinformed." Well, 100 years have passed. And the national media, which is where people get their news now, hasn't changed from what Mark Twain observed 100 years ago. So I was all over trying to read stuff. Now, what I can gather from the Bundy thing, and I don't take his side or I don't take the BLM side, except I would be suspicious of the BLM because that's a government entity. And you can never trust bureaucracies. You can never trust experts. And I got tons of showbiz stories for you later to back that up. But in any event, basically the story was that his cattle were grazing on public land. And he was not paying fees to the Bureau of Land Management. And he hadn't paid them for 20-some-odd years. And the courts ruled twice that he should pay the fees. But he offered to pay the fees to Clark County, which is where some of that ranch area is. Clark County declined to take it because they weren't managing the land. The BLM was supposedly managing the land, but they were managing to put most cattle ranchers out of business, and this guy was the last one standing. And BML said that he was hurting or endangering the desert tortoise. Well, let me tell you how bizarre the government is. About 3 years ago, at a cost of $1 million a year, bless their hearts, Clark County started a reserve and a rescue area and an incubation area and a breeding area for desert tortoises right here in Las Vegas. And it was extremely successful. They bred turtles, and there were hundreds of them. They tried to take them and put them back into the wild. They would also breed snakes and try to put them back in the wild. Well, it turns out that there's not much development going on around Las Vegas these days, or not enough to fund $1 million for these turtles. So you know what they're doing now? They're closing this sanctuary, Chuck, and they're killing the turtles. They're going to put them in an incinerator, for crying out loud, like they do stray dogs and stray cats. Now, on the other hand, you got the BML upset at some cows who are supposedly endangering turtles, when they, in fact, on the other hand, are killing them. But the truth is, cattle do not endanger turtles. As a matter of fact, they probably help them, because the cattle dumpings all over the desert are supply nutrients that those turtles could eat. So what the thing that Bundy had going for him is that his Mormon ancestors had been working that land for like 100 years or just a long, long time. So he felt that he could enforce what he called squatter's rights, which is a legal precedent in this country and many courts, that if you're on property for a long enough time, it's yours. So that's why he refused to pay those fees. Well, it seems that George Knapp's friend, the sheriff here in town, has worked out a deal where the BLM is going to back off, and this fellow Bundy can continue to allow his cattle to graze. Now, I don't trust the government, but I do trust George, and I do trust his instincts, and I do trust his friendship with the sheriff, and the sheriff says that it's been defused. But if you look at other aspects of what's going on the internet, you'll find that there's still a lot of civilians out there carrying guns. There are a lot of BLM snipers still out there. They still have helicopters flying around. So maybe it hasn't entirely been diffused.
Right. And I would say that, you know, it's always good for the public to keep their eyes on these kinds of things, because otherwise, if you allow the government in any way, shape, or form to sort of act in the dark, then none of us are going to see what really happens. And, you know, that is exactly how dangerous things end up happening, don't they?
Yeah, well, you know, it sort of brings a wry smile to my face, because here you have this fellow saying that, you know, it's squatter's rights. He's been there for 100 years. And I wonder now if the Navajo are going to tell BML that, you know, New Mexico is really ours because we've lived here for 10,000 years.
That would be an interesting way to go.
Yeah, I certainly hope they try it.
Well, you know, they certainly couldn't manage the land any worse than the other land management organizations that have attempted to do it in recent times, that's for sure. So, you know...
I also had the bizarre feeling. I mean, there are a lot of kind of warped people out there, and there are lots of people on the Internet who were referring to this as another potential Waco, which it wasn't, because... this guy and his family were not arming themselves to shoot at BML. They armed themselves with cameras and iPads and phones so that they could photograph these people, even though the son was arrested and sort of manhandled a little bit. But it wasn't a Waco. But you look back at Waco, there is absolutely no reason in this world for the United States government to have murdered those people for any reason. It would have been so simple to just surround them and starve them out. And it is beyond me. I mean, I think there were 87 blacks, women and children and men, killed at Waco. And not one word from Jesse Jackson or... this guy that's on MSNBC with his own show, you never heard one squawk out of them. And whenever Bill Clinton is interviewed, and he's interviewed all over the place, nobody has the balls to say, what about Waco or what about NAFTA, the North American Fair Trade Agreement that sent all our jobs overseas? Nobody asks them.
John, one second, because I do have a caller coming in. One sec.
Terrific.
Hey, Vince.
Hey.
How you doing, man?
Doing good. How you doing? I'm worn out. I ain't been to bed since I got here yesterday. I probably walked 100 miles.
Well, listen. What are you able to discern out there? I mean, does it look like it's been resolved? They have an agreement in place? What's going on?
It's over. We won the battle, but of course I think they're probably going to come back with a federal warrant and charge him with the domestic terrorist. That's going to be my suspicion, okay? His words were, okay, let's go over there and let's take them gates down and turn these cattle loose. I mean, I think the way his words were spoken, I think they might be able to charge him. And I think that may be what they'll do. Now, as soon as he made his announcement that when Gillespie did not return within 1 hour with the guns that he demanded of the federal agents be placed at the flag before us, he gave an extra 5 minutes. They said, let's load up, boys, right out. And, man, we shut the freeway down north and southbound. People were hours getting through there.
Well, this was the horses that they sent out to bring the cattle sort of through that area where there's an underpass, right?
Yeah, where I'm sitting and looking up north at the Virgin River right here, it wouldn't be no more than probably a mile and a half or two, where the wash, which runs under the interstate with, you know, the bridge over it. So there was a gate up under there. There were armed agents on the other side with about, I'm going to guess there were at least 100 cowboys and other, there were militia, there were common people, there were run-of-the-day people, there were old people, young people. Every walk of life turned out for here. And any petty differences, you know what, nobody even worried about that. I've never seen in my life such continuity between people in such large crowds. I noticed a couple of people that were kind of lurking and sneaking pictures around, and you could tell by their body language they were not part of this group, and they were just here to document who all was here. So,
you know what's important to me here, Vince, though, is that despite all the documentation and the rhetoric that's been thrown around, I don't think there's been any real serious injuries that I've heard about. And the fact that it was done peaceably is definitely a plus because some of us were afraid, and John is my guest right now. John Barber, you're on with him also, was just talking about how people were concerned that it was going to be another Waco incident, which was an absolute atrocity and was clearly just a case of state militarized murder. But the bottom line here is that I don't see any serious injuries. I know the one son had been tasered a few times, and you know, and there was another lady that got slammed on the ground and this kind of thing. But relatively speaking, for the amount of people that came out there, and for the amount of conflict and the amount of damage that could have been done to human life, I got to say that that I'm very, very glad that that we're looking at a real minimum here. So.
You can't believe the tension that was broken after, you know, both sides, and they came to the agreement to for all the BLM agents, all the federal agents to leave. And, I mean, it took a long time for them to leave that compound. It was a batch plant or a quarry over there where they, you know, dig up the rocks and crush them for road use. But anyways, we all first appeared, there's a big turnout, and then the crossover, the big white crossover, and on the other side over there, just down a little ways, there's a road that goes under the interstate that runs through the wash, and it was gated. So, you know, while everybody was staging at that first spot, shut the interstate down, I grabbed my sign, says media, and I walked out into the interstate, and I held my sign up, and I was so surprised that two highway patrolmen said, come on, you know, I'm walking over there with a phone. I said, I'm the media. And so I'm looking around. There's like three other guys over there. It's media guys. Excuse me. I've about wore my throat out. Pardon me.
That's all right, Vince. You know, I saw Channel 8, which I think is a CBS affiliate locally there, was there on the scene. We also saw, like, Pete Santilli was out there. A few other people were out there. And I was just kind of glad that there were some eyes on the scene, because, you know, again, criminals don't conduct business in broad daylight, generally speaking. So I felt like at least that was accomplished for certain. And what else did you have to add?
Yeah, now when we first hit that first staging area, like I said, I crossed the road, they had a gauntlet on down there of all Clark County deputies, probably a good 40 or 60 foot across. And I walked up and they said, stop. So I stopped, I turned around, I raised my hand, I said, y'all want to search me? I said, I'm with the media, and I have some questions. No, but no response. But you know what? I am not kidding you, man. I was shaking, dude. I didn't know what was going to happen. I went up there by myself, and another guy followed me with a camera to document it, whatever. I didn't know if I was going to get shot, rubber bullets, mace, tasered, or what.
Well, I got news for you, Vince. When you get on the scene in some of these tense situations, this is exactly the kind of risk that every one of those guys has taken. Some of them got vests on, some of them don't. But this is the way it's really done, man. So, look, I'm going to let you go, Vince. But I know you'll be checking in with a couple other people and updating the situation. Is there anything like major you want to add to this, because I'm feeling pretty good about the way it's gone so far. And John was just talking about how he knows George Knapp, who's a reporter over there, and also we know him from Coast to Coast AM, and how he had already explained to him that that they had cut that deal with the local sheriff there, and that it looked like it was going to be at least handled peaceably one way or another. I mean, you know, court injunctions in the future and all that aside, we have no idea.
Yeah, there's a lot to come yet. They were smart, I think, to back off, because this side was not going to back down. And it was a wonderful feeling of elation when the word came down that the feds were backing down, they were leaving, and they're going to release the cattle. So it was fantastic. I was privileged to talk to many members of the family. Became personal. I became involved with setting up the vent this morning. I got the got it hooked up for they needed a new amp and a bunch of other stuff I was involved with. I'm the only one on the stage filming and recording. And all the other media are out in front. So no matter what media that you see, you're going to see me up on there on the stage for UCY TV. And I'm proud and privileged and very honored to be here and to have been the eyes and ears for all of us here.
Well, thank you, man. You did a really good job, and I was glad that I could at least help out a little bit to, you know, give you a couple
of videos. I got a lot of interviews, and recording. So we'll be getting together, Josh, Anti-Tyranny News, and you and I think we're going to get together and put something together. So, hey, thanks a bunch, Chuck. You're a great guy, man, and appreciate you being here on UCY.TV. Hey, Jax. Jax, I spoke with Lori, the prepper chick Lori, the other people I called and was in contact with, contacted by a few other networks, so they want to meet on through tonight, too. So I've got a lot of radio tonight lined up if I can keep my voice held. So anyways, love and peace, y'all, in chat. Thank you,
right.
Thank
look,
you.
No matter what goes on, Vince, just make sure you keep your head down if anything does go wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm going to be heading back to Vegas here pretty soon.
All right. Be well, brother.
Thanks.
So, John, you still with me?
Oh, absolutely. And that's terrific that you had Vince out there. But I do not think the federal government, as Vince said, will come back with some kind of federal warrant. The eyes of the entire country and the world are on Mr. Bundy. And I think that the government will be very, very standoffish when it comes with dealing with him. And I would hope that Mr. Bundy chooses wisely the person that he chooses to do his very first interview with. I would not call this a victory. You're not victorious usually over the federal government. What it is, it's a successful standoff. It's a way of maybe manning the barricades, and the barricades held up this time. But there
won't be people. That was kind of the point I was trying to make, that that at least it had been diffused to a degree, and that nobody was, there wasn't a great spilling of blood, basically, which is what I was concerned, literally, that this could immediately escalate into something where...
I have a feeling that there were a lot of people on the Internet that were hoping it would turn into that because they have such a hatred for the federal government. In many instances, that hatred is justified, but there are other ways to handle it. And I would hope that Mr. Bundy's first choice of a lengthy interview would be with George Knapp, because George is probably the only one who would interview him without taking a political stance. I mean, if he goes and he's interviewed by Hannity or Riley or Alex Jones, they are using him as a straight man for their platform and for their politics. George Knapp would never do that. So I would hope Mr. Bundy chooses wisely when he goes public with his story.
Well, that's why there is a big difference between a media figure with an agenda and a journalist. That's exactly the difference, the way I see it anyway, John. But who knows? Maybe I'm just one of those crazy people that sees it that way.
well, journalism almost does not exist in America anymore. What you have now is you have news of opinion. You don't have news of fact. And I think I may have mentioned to you before that if it hadn't been for Ronald Reagan's getting rid of the fairness doctrine, there would have never been any Fox network. You wouldn't have had, you may have had a Hannity, and you may have had an O'Reilly, but you wouldn't have a 24-hour-a-day propaganda arm for the right wing of the Republican Party, because with the fairness doctrine, you would at least have to contribute 12 hours to the other side, to Democrats and socialists and Nazis and flat earthers, or any political party that could get 5% of the public vote. But Ronald Reagan got rid of that as soon as Jim Garrison got to the airwaves after NBC committed crimes at trying to sabotage his case against Clay Shaw. And when he got his half hour on late night television to talk against the federal government and the Central Intelligence Agency and name names and show pictures, well, the owners of the country, who are certainly not the citizens, realize we can't have that kind of truth-telling on television, even if it's at 11:30 at night. So they passed the Fairness Doctrine, and ownership of media went from 1970 to about 5,000 independents to only 6 major corporations, and that's in 45 years. So that is really, really scary. And the six corporations now are different straws in the same septic tank, promoting the federal government and the corporatocracy under which we live.
And I absolutely couldn't state it any better myself, I'll tell you that, because, you know, and the prerequisites for this stuff was in place before Reagan, because there were intelligence assets, as we're starting to learn through declassified files, inserted into just about, I mean, CBS and NBC had primary examples of people that were directly working with and for the intelligence agencies of the United States government. So the agendas, I mean, look, a brief example, besides Garrison, which, by the way, if you want to see the difference between what NBC did to him and then what NBC allowed him to do, they're both up on my YouTube channel and my Daily Motion channel. If you just look for me, you'll find it there, and you'll see the NBC special. I think I titled it The Hatchet Job on Jim Garrison on television. And it was something that NBC tried to keep out of the hands of everybody for a long time. And then the very simple sort of black and white airing of Garrison just sitting there on a desk and looking right into the camera and explaining himself and explaining how you're basically told a lot of fairy tales by the media all the time. This happened, and I show it to you. I show you both things to let you know what it looked like back then. But this did disappear, and I think it is an amazing sort of, you know, when people complain about the way the media is, and I say this all the time, if you want to complain about it, then do something about it, become part of it, and change the way things are done. Now, I know that we're not going to be able to take down these giant corporate entities that you're talking about that control the majority of what I always refer to as the mainstream, but if our voices are out there and more people are starting to listen to us, even if we are not necessarily as well funded or as widely broadcast. If there's a million of us and we each have three listeners and they don't have 3 million listeners, it seems to me as though it's a win. So always participate in it as best you can. If you don't like what you see, make what you want to see. Okay.
Well, good for you on all those counts, especially carrying the stuff that NBC did to Garrison and Jim's response. And you can see in that response, you know, aside from the three sets of the Warren Commission, the Warren Report that he carried, though it's 26 volumes times three, he had a set in the car, a set in the office, and a set at home. But at home, he also had, and in his office, the complete works of William Shakespeare. And when you see him sitting on that desk, he's like 6 feet six. He's sitting on that desk, and he leans forward, and he says, "You take these words, the word of these honorable men." Well, it's like the oration speech in Julius Caesar. I mean, that's how bright and articulate and learned the man was. The most encouraging thing about the Bundy thing is that this grassroots resistance to federal bureaucracy started on the internet. It didn't start in the mainstream media. And it grew to the point where the mainstream media, I mean, Hannity even had a commentary about it the other day, it grew to the point where they had to pay attention. And they paid attention. And so I think that's very, very encouraging. And I think it would probably help shows like yours and all these other guerrilla talk shows on the internet. And that's what you are. You're a guerrilla journalist. And the word is going to expand and expand. And already you're going to get two more nights aside from Saturday night. So good for you, good for the listeners, and good for America. Are you still there?
There we go. There we go. Oh, no, nothing. I just had a little trouble clicking off the mute on my mic symbol there. Computers sometimes don't cooperate with us.
I told you, anybody who has Windows should get out of them, especially people who do your kind of shows, because I go to all kinds of sites, and sometimes the sites are very suspect, and your computer gets infected with a virus. And I had Windows for like 5 years, and I was calling my computer guru over here twice a week to clean out all these viruses. And he told me, you know, the federal government and the military, they use Macintosh. You must get a Mac. And I said, I'm not spending $3,600. I barely know the typewriter. He said, I'll get you a Mac Mini. He got me a Mac Mini, Chuck, cost $750. It is absolutely foolproof, and it's no bigger than a small box of chocolates. You can make movies on it. You can make music on it. You can do everything with it. And I've never had a problem since I got it. The year and a half I have it. So you've got to get rid of your Windows once you start making a little more money and get yourself a Mac Mini.
Yeah, I really think I'm going to. And you're not the first guy to tell me this either. But anyway, yeah, it's definitely not the way to go at this point, especially with, you know, the recent things with them not having being able to secure the XP and all this other stuff. I'm not claiming to understand any of it, by the way, but I do understand that that this thing is sometimes more trouble than I think most people can imagine.
Well, evidently, Bill Gates, even though he's one of the wealthiest men in the world, and I guess as such, has an awful lot of very bright and wealthy enemies. And it's so easy for a lot of these people who are really bright with this kind of technology to create worms and bugs and viruses that just destroy Windows, and they're doing it all the time to them. And that's why anybody who has Windows is going to be in trouble. They're going to be infected all the time unless they just go to very, very safe sites. And, of course, if you're going to be a journalist on the Internet, you cannot deal in safe sites. You have to go to unsafe and unsavory places to dig out what it is you're trying to dig out.
Exactly. What was it Garrison used to say about that? That, you know, I would love to have altar boys and you know.
Oh yeah. Who else are you gonna get as witnesses? You know.
Exactly. I mean, in essence, and I'm going to paraphrase here, and I'm going to butcher it terribly. I should remember the quote, but I don't at the moment. He basically said, look, if you're going to look for witnesses to criminal activity, who do you expect the witnesses to be other than, you know, either lower-level criminals or unsavory people? That's generally what you're going to get, who's going to be close enough to see the details you want. So,
and I guess the last word about the Bundy thing is that the Internet is covered with stories about Harry Reid and his son being involved with this Chinese energy company. And, Harry was born in a little town just about 20 miles here from Las Vegas. And the moment he was born, first thing he did was stuck his thumb in his mouth, and his mother knew right away he was going to be a politician, because all politicians suck. But in any event, Harry Reid and his son do indeed have this relationship with a Chinese energy company that is interested in building a solar plant of some sort near a town of Laughlin. And a lot of the people that were all over the Bundy story were trying to relate the Reed's entanglement with the Chinese and this solar plant as some kind of land grab for the Chinese. Well, for God's sake, Laughlin is 100 miles from the Bundy Ranch or Overton where he lives, for crying out loud. So people should know that. The Reed's may be like all politicians, bordering on being just bums, but the truth is that it wasn't a land grab on behalf of the Reeds or the Chinese. It was just American bureaucracy and the federal government trying to strong-arm people as they usually do. And fortunately, they were backed off the barricades thanks to the Internet, people like you, people like Vince, and people like George Knapp.
And also, you know, one other thing that I do want to add to that is that for once, because we're always inundated, and I am one who is guilty of probably accentuating sometimes police brutality, because I feel as though it is a serious violation of a public trust to abuse that uniform, and I have very strong feelings about that. But the fact is that the law enforcement people that were on the ground, the local guys that were there, were actually conducting themselves in a very safe manner. They were actually doing their jobs the right way and actually doing what we always used to see printed on police cars, which said to protect and serve. They actually were doing that in this situation, and I think that needs to be mentioned as well. But I certainly don't want to spend the whole time on the Bundy thing with you, John, that's for sure. But I'm so glad that, that I got to hear your take on it because, you know, again, I just, you know, I really, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around what happened there. And it's always hard for people to wrap their minds around things when they're not there and they're not able to see up close what's going on.
Well, I said earlier, Chuck, that you can never trust the experts. And you can never trust management because the chances are they're going to be incredibly wrong. And I can tell you a couple of showbiz stories that underscore that very, very clearly. I mean, it is surprising how totally dumb the experts can be, which means how totally dumb our leaders can be because they're supposed to be experts. One of the most charming, most wonderful nights I ever spent was with George Burns. I had, after I left Real People, after I was fired from Real People over my confrontations with the owner of the show, over his deliberately maligning and slandering Jim Garrison in the story that he re-edited for broadcast on NBC, and as a result of that, I had to leave Real People, but I was approached by Edie Adams. Edie Adams was a wonderful girl singer who married Ernie Kovacs, and she said that she wanted somebody who could tell Ernie Kovacs' story, and she said she'd been approached by everybody in America, because she had these 40 hours of Ernie's stuff, and she said, she said she didn't trust anyone to tell the story, and she wanted complete control over her husband's work. And I thought she should have the control over it, because after all, she saved the work from oblivion, because what ABC had done for a long time, and they had taken Ernie Kovacs' shows and did weather reports with the tapes. And so a lot of Ernie's stuff was lost. In any event, she came to me and asked me if I would do it. And I said, well, I will do it. So I did this documentary called Ernie Kovacs, Television's Original Genius, was nominated for a Peabody. And if you go to John Barber's World, which is my site, you can see this documentary for nothing. And the LA Times said it was the best documentary ever made about a performer. And I guarantee you, up until Looking for Sugar Man. Looking for Sugar Man was the greatest show business story I ever saw. But my documentary is the best documentary about an American performer. Believe me, it is. Anyway, so we did that, okay? And she was going to perform at a place called the Pantages Theater in Hollywood, which is where they used to hold the Academy Awards. And what it was sort of a farewell appearance by a lot of performers in their 50s and 60s and 70s. And one of the performers was Frankie Lane. And then her date that night was George Burns. Now, after the show, the show's over at 10:30. So we used to go to this, oh, God, I wish I could remember the name, Scandia. Was a restaurant on Sunset Boulevard, and they used to have a late dinner menu. And that late dinner menu consisted of a small filet mignon steak with a beefsteak tomato. And that was my favorite meal ever, 10:30 at night. So we go there after the show. We get there about 10:45. There is Edie Adams, my son, who was only 10 or 11 at the time, I think he was 11 years of age, and my son, by the way, was the one who discovered Sarah Purcell. That's how she ended up on the show. But in any event, it was a fellow named Henry Bollinger, who was Edie's agent, a close friend of Ernie Kovacs. There was a publicist friend of George Burns, and myself and my wife. We sat around this table beginning at 10:45. From 10:45 till 2:45 in the morning, George regaled us with showbiz stories about his life and the life of his friends. None of us barely spoke a word, and that's why he said none of his friends ever liked to play golf with him, because he would never shut up, and they never got a chance. Even if they hit a ball wrong, they never got a chance to hole four, because George wouldn't shut up. But in any event, the whole restaurant was deserted. The restaurant closed at midnight, and everybody left except the manager and a busboy. And the eight of us sitting around this big dining room table. And this is one of the stories that he told. So that, and it's just an amazing showbiz story. And it concerns Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Lucy did a radio show called I Love Lucy. Mm-hmm. Now, you're too young to remember it. But her husband on the show was this really nice-looking Irish and American actor named Richard Denning. Really nice looking. Looked like Dennis Morgan. He used to be under contract to Warner Brothers. Anyway, CBS decided that they would like to make a pilot of their successful radio show and went to Lucy. And Lucy said, yeah, I'd love to do it, and I love Richard, but I want my real husband to be my husband.
Right, and this is from the days when radio was really the TV back then, because it had been, had all these serialized series and many, many, many shows, all types, entertainment shows.
Jack Benny, Fred Allen, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, I mean, all of them. And so the reason a lot of early television was good was the people who made television boxes had to have something for people to look at. So what they did is they went to performers who were polished, they went to professors who could talk, and these people got shows. They even gave Bishop Sheen a show, for crying out loud, because he could talk, and Bishop Sheen's the guy that knocked Milton Berle off the air. But that's why so much of early television was so good, because when you wanted a newsman, you went to Charles Collingwood, you went to Edward R. Murrow. These were guys who were in the Second World War, newsmen. Anyway, back to the story. So she said, I want Desi to be my husband. And they said, he's Cuban. He speaks Spanish. She says, I don't care. It's Spanish pillow talk, and I love to listen to it. I want him to do it. And they said, no. She said, well, I'm not going to do a pilot. So she continued to do the radio show, and they came back again. And they said, there is a great deal of interest at the network. They've done research, and they know the audience would love to have you on television. And she said, okay, but I want my real husband. And they said, no, they expect you to have Richard Denning. And she said, well, forget it. Let them know that I'm really married to a Cuban. They came back to her a week later, and they said, we've agreed to do a pilot with your husband, Desi. So she was thrilled. She tells her husband, we're going to do this television show. Lucy loved writers, so she hired three of the best writers in the business, and they set up the Lucy show. And Desi was a really, really bright guy, so he's the one that developed shooting with three cameras in front of a live audience, and they did the show, and it was terrific. And CBS happened to show it to a cigarette sponsor named Old Gold, quite by accident. And Old Gold bought a whole season of the show, and they had only done the pilot. So they came back to Lucy and said, we've got a year's commitment for the show. And she said, what show? And they said, the pilot you just did. And she said, well, I told you I want my husband in the pilot. And they said, well, he's in the pilot. And she said, but he's not in the contract. They had neglected to get a contract with Desi Arnaz for I Love Lucy. So guess what? Lucy ended up owning the show because they had already sold it to Old Gold. So much for the networks who and the experts who run the world. They forgot to get a contract with Desi. And that she became the most successful woman in television. She created Desi Lou Studios and a lot of wonderful shows in the early days of television.
And just to put that in context, John, Desi Lou Studios was, I believe, the original home for Star Trek.
That's right.
Also, another interesting fact
Danny Thomas's show.
Absolutely. There was also the fact that, and it might sound strange to my listeners now, but cigarette companies used to sponsor a lot of things. Even if you search around, I bet you can find the Flintstones doing Winston commercials. Believe it or not.
Well, I forget the guy's name, but there was a very famous anchorman on CBS who did cigarette commercials, and he smoked on the air while he was doing the news. He was very, very famous. I wish I could remember his name, but I can't remember it offhand.
Well, there are a lot of guys, even if you watch, you know, because I've gone over the footage many, many times of the day that John F. Kennedy died and that entire weekend. And I've got to tell you that the majority of the anchormen actually were smoking. There was an ashtray on the news desk while they were live on the air, and they cut away and went to 24-hour news coverage for the first time, I believe, when John F. Kennedy was killed. And you can see right there the ashtray, the cigarettes are right there. Even in the local Dallas reporters were sitting there speaking to witnesses.
And you know what? Even in those days, there were underground reports and photographs of lungs destroyed by nicotine. It took 50 years to get that stuff labeled as a poison on cigarette packages, and it's the same kind of label they should have on anything in this country that contains sugar. Sugar is a poison, and that's one of the reasons for this enormous outbreak of diabetes in this country is because of sugar and corn syrups and corn products.
And
that
should
all be labeled a poison.
And the types of sugars they use and everything else, quite honestly, if you take a look at the extremely alarming rise in the cancer rates, it has a great deal to do with this, I'm told, by some people that work.
If you have a pet, you may wonder why your cat or your dog is getting diabetes, because if you look at the ingredients on pet food, it all contains corn syrup. Mm-hmm. And that's what they become addicted to, and that turns to sugar in their system. And they get, I've lost a couple of animals to that. And finally, somebody put me onto we have two stray cats that we've adopted, put me onto a product called Blue Buffalo. And Blue Buffalo is all natural cat food, I guess, or natural dog food. And our two saved and stray cats are just thriving on Blue Buffalo because it doesn't have sugar or corn syrup in it. Anyway, if you want to hear another story about experts and how they don't know anything, since I know so much about my experience in television, if you want to hear another one, I'll tell you another one.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, And you know what? It's something that I think is missed a lot now, because George Burns isn't really mentioned anymore, in a lot of the media, as far as even in the entertainment business. They don't recognize not only the long career the guy had, but, I mean, he was incredibly, intermingled with every single star of about four different eras this guy worked with. And I mean, you know, you're talking about even working with, guys in the 70s like Ritter and all them, every TV star at some point, and just about every major star, comedians, singers, all kinds, actually wound up rubbing elbows with this guy at some point or another. I would love to see a serialized version of his life story somewhere, I'll tell you that.
Well, George performed at Caesar's Palace when he was 98, which was about 10 or 15 years ago. Just an absolutely adorable human being. He didn't have a mean bone in his body. As a matter of fact, every bone in his body was a funny bone. Anyway, this is another story. One of the really good sitcoms that was on television in the 70s was a show called Barney Miller. Barney Miller had no laugh track at all, and it's one of the few comedy shows. It was a group comedy show, company comedy show, in which the actors never yelled. I mean, they spoke to one another. I mean, if you look at any, I can't watch any sitcom on the air today. I mean, Seinfeld may have been the last show that I ever took a look at because people talk to one another. There are a couple on HBO that are not bad. I forget the guy that was a co-creator of Seinfeld has a show.
Oh, the Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, Curb Your Enthusiasm. They just talk. They don't yell at one another. So, but Barney Miller had no laugh track. Anyway, the creator of the show, or the co-creator, he took credit for creating the show, but he was actually the co-creator who screwed his partner out of his share of it. And his name was Danny Arnold, and he had had a show on ABC with Marlo Thomas. It was called That Girl. And in that show, half of the show took place in the office, and half of the show took place in the apartment. Anyway, when he and his partner for a while created Barney Miller, one of the producers of the show, one of the head writers, was one of my best friends and my son's godfather. His name was Chris Hayward. Chris Hayward and his partner, Alan Burns, created a show called The Munsters.
Mm.
And The Munsters, they gave the concept to their agent. The agent went to Screen Gems and sold it to Screen Gems as though he had created the show. And Chris and Alan spent a dozen years in court before the courts ruled that the show really belonged to Chris Hayward and Alan Burns. That's what kind of thieves populate this business. Anyway, Chris was involved with Get Smart. And because That Girl had been successful, do you remember the show, Barney Miller?
Yeah, I do. The one thing that I remember about it really vividly was that it was almost always on the one set, basically.
That's exactly right. It was a very seedy police station set. I mean, it looked like a New York police station. It looked seedy, and it was seedy. But in any event, I'm glad you remember that because that's crucial to the story. Anyway, Danny, because of the success of That Girl, he tried to imitate it by putting the first half of the show in the apartment or in the precinct, and the second half either in the apartment or the precinct, because he wanted to duplicate the success he had with That Girl. Anyway, and he signs, I'm trying to remember the name of the lead actor. It will come to me. A very nice fellow who sang very well, very good performer. Anyway, he and his wife, of course, were signed to 5- and 7-year contracts by Danny with options every year. So anyway, Chris Hayward was a big fan of the Kirk Douglas movie, The Detective. Hmm. And The Detective all took place on one set. It was a very successful film, 90 minutes. So Chris went to Danny and said, hey, you know what? Why don't we just have this show all the time take place on the one set, like the movie? And Danny said, no, it'll never work. It can't work. I mean, it's a half-hour show. People don't want to look at this grungy set for a half hour. So Chris said, well, look at that. He looked at it at a movie theater for 90 minutes, and they paid to look at it. Danny said, no, but this is in people's living rooms. They don't want to look at that. So ABC, the ratings were not good, and ABC was on the verge of canceling the show. So the 13th episode, Chris Hayward wrote. And what he wrote was a huge snowstorm in New York City as they had this past year. And the guys in the precinct couldn't get home. They could only phone. So the entire show had to be shot on the set of the police station. Anyway, a very famous critic, his first name is Richard something or other, for Time Life magazine. Richard happens to catch the 13th episode. And it was a terrific show, really wonderfully written and wonderfully performed. And he gave it a very nice review. ABC read that review and decided to pick up Barney Miller and told Danny to keep it in the precinct all the time. And Danny said, well, it won't work. So he kept the girl who played the wife under contract for 5 years waiting for the show to fail and only used her 3 times.
That figures. You know, I think I remember seeing that that episode where they were phoning home and stuff because they couldn't leave.
That's exactly it. So again, so much for the experts. They don't know. And listen, when who's that guy was? Freddie Silverman, when he was head of programming at CBS. He canceled Hollywood Squares because he said, this will never make it. It went over to NBC and became one of the most successful shows on television. They do not know. They just don't know. So
it's just one of those things where they put these guys in charge and they tell you they have all the answers, but they don't. Meanwhile, Barney Miller spawned the show Fish. I remember Abe Bogota was on that.
Abe Bogota, that's right. And I'll tell you sort of a nice showbiz story, because it's certainly true in my life, and I don't know about yours or any of your listeners, but I used to do a routine in my act about all the good things that happened to us happened by accident, and all the worst things are those things that are really well planned. But in any event, I used to, aside from appearing regularly on the Merv Griffin Show doing stand-up, I was on Dean Martin's show quite often. Mm. And this is a really, really nice story. Dean was, I think, probably the most professional, successful performer I ever met. Because when you're doing rehearsals for a show, you're in a studio the size of a barn. And there are about 12 or 14 people around, and people have to get up and sing their act or dance their act or speak their act if they're comics. And you'd think there'd be all kinds of distractions. People would get bored or edgy, and there's no audience. Dean Martin was at every rehearsal and never let anyone talk or do anything to distract anybody from performing, even if it was a total unknown like me or Peggy Lee or Van Johnson or Frank Sinatra or anybody. Nobody could be out of line in any way or be any distraction to somebody who was rehearsing. Anyway, when Dean started his show, again, this is the experts again at NBC. Here's this really polished, good-looking Italian-American in the tuxedo smoking his cigarette and singing his love song. So they wanted him to be sort of a high roller and a really suave, sophisticated guy on television. Gave him this television show, and it was bombing. It was absolutely dying. Mm. And so Dean met this guy named Greg Garrison. And Greg Garrison, at one time, when he was in college, had been fired by Orson Welles from a show, from a comedy made when Orson was doing a show at this college. But in any event, he ended up in Hollywood, and he bumped into Dean Martin, and Dean asked him if he'd be interested in maybe taking a look at his show, and would he like to maybe produce the show, or what's wrong with the show, give me a critique. And Greg said, well, first of all, Dean, you know, they have you, this suave guy, which you are, and You know, but you're an Italian Ed Sullivan on the show. But that's not what you really are. You're this playboy. You should come out there. You're a saloon singer. You should sit on the edge of the piano with a piano player with a drink of scotch in your hand. And you should be surrounded by a bunch of girls, gold diggers. You should be surrounded by gold diggers. So Dean said, would you produce my show? Just on that short comment that Greg made. And they shook hands. And Dean said, I'll give you half the show because I don't have anything anyway if it doesn't work. Dean and Greg never had a signed contract. Dean Martin became the most successful variety show in the history of television. Dean Martin became the largest single shareholder in General Electric, which owned NBC. And when he died, his handshake held up for the estate of Greg Garrison.
Wow.
Is that a great story?
That's a great story because, you know, it's so often we hear about, you know, the bad side of things. And
yeah, and I'll tell you about how sweet Dean was. Dean was a junkie golfer. He would have had to cut back, really, to be a junkie. He used to play at Riviera all the time. There were two guys that were there who took him for $1,000 or $2,000 every day, and he knew it. But he didn't mind. He could afford to lose it. As a matter of fact, Don Cherry, who was one of his best friends and a very successful golfer, Don's about 84 now, lives here in Las Vegas, he had warned Dean about these guys hustling him. Don Cherry was a professional golfer and a great singer. You can Google him and listen to some of his stuff, the gold band and gold ring. I mean, he had some really great hits. He substituted for Dean a couple of times on his show, but when he went to Dean and told Dean, you know, got to watch out for these guys, Dean never spoke to him again. Never. The rest of his life, he never spoke to him again because it was negative about two of his friends, and he didn't mind losing to him. Anyway, my son was the Caucasian Tiger Woods. He was on the news when he was 2, and he was on the news again when he was 4, hitting golf balls. Well, one day, I'm out at Riviera, and I'm hitting golf balls, and next to me is my son. He has his own little clubs, and he cut down, and he's 6 years of age. And I've done 2 of Dean shows by this time. And it reminded me to tell you a Garrison story about this also, a Jim Garrison story as well as a Greg Garrison story. So please remind me. Anyway, Dean says, kid, Johnny, that kid's, he's unbelievable. I said, yeah, he is. He is. He was just a natural. He just taught himself, picked it up by himself. So Dean went over to him and said, what's your name? And my son said, Christopher. He said that he called you Chris. He said, my friends call me Chris, but my parents call me Christopher. So I would prefer it if you called me Christopher. Well, Dean howled. He said, okay, Christopher, how'd you like to play 18 holes at Riviera? Now my son's 6, for crying out loud. And Dean's 2 friends see this and come over and try to corral Dean to go out and, you know, you've done your good deed to the day, you know, be nice to the kid. Let's go out and play some golf. And he said, no, we'll play tomorrow. I'm going to play with the kid. He put my son in the golf cart. They would both go to, they went to the first tee, and they would tee off, and my son's ball would go 30 or 35 yards. Dean's would go 210. They would drive out, pick up my son's ball, take it to Dean's ball, and then hit it again. He played the entire 18 holes with my son. And he told me it was one of the greatest days he ever had in his life. He said, actually, the 2 dead best days I had in my life were the day I met Jerry Lewis and the day I left Jerry Lewis. But this has to rank in the top 10 of the most enjoyable days I ever spent in my life. Well, about 18 years ago, 15 years ago, I was going through some stuff at home in my archives, and I came across this picture of Dean. I thought, God, oh, I better write to him because I was making some notes. I wanted to write and tell him this story again and how much my son to this day remembers that moment. And as soon as I started writing the letter, I turned on the news and they announced that Dean Martin had died. So I never got a chance to send it to him. But anyway, two quick stories about Greg Garrison. This is so weird. My wife, do you remember an actress who was Jennifer Jones? Remember Jennifer Jones, Dueling in the Sun, Gregory Peck?
Oh, right, right, okay.
Okay. Are you drifting off somewhere?
No, no, I was thinking.
Yeah, okay. Jennifer Jones was a stunning, stunning woman. She was in, I think, Carrie with Laurence Olivier. A lot of very successful films. Well, my wife could have been her twin sister. Really beautiful brunette. The best tap dancer I ever saw outside of Fred Astaire was my wife. And that includes Eleanor Parker, okay? Just phenomenal. Anyway, we're at, I'll tell the bad story first, and then I'll tell sort of a good story. And they're both short. Anyway, Greg Garrison came up to me one day, and he said, you know, your wife is beautiful. I said, thank you. And he said, you know, my favorite people are Latins. It seemed everybody he dated was a Latin. My wife's name was Sarita, and she was Latin. So I said, well, that's nice. And he said, how would your wife feel if I asked her out? And I said, well, why are you asking me? He said, well, what do you think she'd say? I said, well, if I were you, before you ask her, I would call Frank Sinatra and say, Frank, you know, John Barber's wife, Sarita, what happened when you asked her out? So I said, you probably get the same answer that Frank got, and she's still with me. And I said, listen, I wake up in the morning often and surprised to find her there because there's so many guys like you hitting on her. But you know what? Whatever she wants to do, she's going to do. Okay, so anyway, I didn't get to do a lot of Dean shows after that. But the third show, that I didn't do it until I did the roast of Red Fox. But in any event, getting back to Jim Garrison, the third show I did, I had a lot of sort of cute jokes about some Jewish heritage in my background, you know. And they were funny, and they always got laughs. And Greg Garrison came to me. This was they have a rehearsal in the empty studio, and then they have a run through with camera and audience. They do this twice. They do the run through camera and audience, and then they do it and they actually tape it. Okay, so we're in the studio with an audience, and this is the run-through with the audience. And he stops after I do my monologue and calls me off to the side. And he said, they're the Jew jokes you did on Merv Griffin's show, right? And I said, yeah. He said, he said, the audience likes them. I can see that. He said, you know what? But I like some of the topical stuff that you do. And even though the show runs a week or two late, sometimes you think you could do something topical that might last a couple of weeks. And I said, well, give me a couple of minutes to think about it. Okay. So he gave me a couple of minutes. Now, the big thing in the news at that time was that Linda Johnson, the daughter of LBJ, was engaged to be wed to a guy by the name of Charlie Robb. Now, Jesus, I haven't thought of this story in 40 years, and how can I remember these names? The reason I remember them is because I can remember the joke. So anyway, I went to Greg and I said, I think I got a line. Okay, I think I got a line. He said, okay. And I said, it takes a little longer to tell than a couple of the Jew jokes. But he said, okay, that's good. So they put me out there in front of the audience. And I said to the audience, as you can see in the papers for the last little while, and I said last little while, even though it was just in that morning's paper, that LBJ's daughter is engaged to this guy, Charles Robb, who I think is in the Air Force Reserve, and I'm telling the audience this, and they're nodding, and that there's to be a wedding shortly, and that Earl Warren has asked Lyndon if he could perform the ceremony. So they're all nodding. And Lyndon said, no. And I said, Earl Warren said, why? And Lyndon said, well, after the Warren report, I don't want to look back in 15 years and find out they aren't really married. Well, the audience exploded with laughter and cheers because they all knew what the government had told us all these years was a crop of crap and nobody was ever going to talk about it here. I came out with this joke and there was an ovation. I couldn't continue with it. They were so thrilled to hear it. So anyway, here, cut from Garrison. And he comes back down on the stage and he puts his arms around me and he comes here. He says, Johnny, that's some of the funniest crap I ever heard, but you're not saying it on my show. Give me the two jokes again.
Wow. Which network was that?
That's NBC.
Oh.
That's NBC.
So wow.
That's that story. But, and I can tell you, since we're talking about showbiz, I'd really love to be talking about Garrison, and we can get to Jim Garrison, and I will briefly, because you mentioned that you had that documentary, that attack piece that NBC did, and that you had Garrison's response in there.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is in the Garrison tapes, and all of that and more is in The Last Word on the Assassination. If you have any interest whatsoever in this case, everything, and I mean everything, you need to know to be fully knowledgeable about the murder of John Kennedy by the Central Intelligence Agency and the military espionage apparatus in this country, you go to Amazon and get the DVD. It's 90 minutes of the Garrison tapes, followed by 50 minutes of the most brilliant panel you've ever heard, Joan Mellon, Dick Russell, and Jim Mars, and you will applaud them. They are so wonderful. Now, I never thought anybody could follow the Garrison tapes at a screening with an audience, but these people not only followed it, they improved the documentary by magnifying and amplifying some of the things that Garrison was trying to do. So that's all I got to say about that. I mean, there are lots of wonderful, wonderful sites, and lots of wonderfully informative books about the subject, trying to get the truth out there. But everything and anything you need to know to become thoroughly knowledgeable is right there. And some of it is going to startle you. It's so scary. In any event.
Absolutely, and I've always said, and you know, long before I ever even had conversation one with you, I have at least two VHS copies still in working order. I have it on DVD, the original documentary without this extra, without the extras that have gone into it, what would you call it? I guess that conference basically in Las Vegas. And the thing is that everybody who has been following me from day one knows that Joan Mellon was the first guest I had on. I'll tell you
how these... It's like, you know, the joke that I did about, you know, I don't want to look back in 15 years and find out that she's not really married. I mean, this comes out of left field and the audience explodes. Well, the same thing seems to have been happening with The Last Word on the Assassination. Do you know that Amazon has 500,000 movies and documentaries? I mean, 500,000. That's a lot to choose from, okay?
Right.
When we went on a little over a month, it took me 3 weeks with the help of a company called Wordsmith Media to get it up on Amazon. When we got up there, we were number 14,000 within 10 days. We were number 13,000, and today we're number 53 in all documentaries on Amazon. And that's without any promotion or publicity. I mean, I've done your show, and I've done the Wrench show. George Knapp's given it a huge plug on his weekend show, and a Black Op Radio with Len Ossanek. They're the only outlets that seem to talk to me about this, and it's just surging. So, I mean, it's just people are anxious, and if you go up to Amazon, you can read not only endorsements from some very, very famous people. What you can read are the reviews from people who've actually spent the $12 to buy the DVD and take their word for it. And some of those reviews are, they almost bring tears to your eyes. They're so, so brilliant. But in any event, you want to hear another showbiz story?
Well, you know, you talked about earlier, you said, remind me to get back to it about the social changes that were, you know, intermingled with this kind of stuff that happened with you. So I was wondering what you meant by that.
Well, you know, I almost never get depressed. I feel enormously lucky, and I feel lucky about the fact that I seem to have a brain that wants to survive. And I always seem, if things get a little harsh, my brain turns it into a joke or a funny observation or something like that. And that's what I use my Facebook page for. But in any event, in thinking about the Kennedy assassination, because there are a number of very good sites, and I go up to a couple of them just to see what people are posting that's new. But there's nothing new up there because I know it all, but I still like to see that these people are doing that. And I got to thinking, you know, the only time I felt a little sad is I looked at this wonderful picture that some woman posted of John Kennedy at a press conference and Jackie standing about 4 feet behind him to his left rear, staring at him with this wonderful look of love and affection on her face. Now, obviously, everybody knew that John Kennedy was a womanizer. Absolutely everybody. And the truth was that Joe Kennedy paid Jackie $1 million to stay with her husband. Okay, that's it. And the truth is, if he had sex with all these women, the truth is, Chuck, it probably made him a better president. And if Bobby and he had an affair with Marilyn Monroe, which they obviously did, that made John a better president, and it made Bobby a better attorney general, because the one thing that turns men into miserable creatures and women into miserable creatures is if they're not getting enough sex, okay? That's just the truth of it. People need to be touched physically. I don't care what anybody said. And that's why you see all these deranged priests buggering boys, for God's sake. I mean, it's sex is the life force of the universe at work. You can't suppress it. You can't repress it. And if you suppress it and repress it, it turns into something ugly. And that's why there's so many ugly Republicans in this country, and even Democrats, okay, and Tea Partiers. They're not getting enough sex, okay? But aside from that.
Well, I got to tell you that just from my own standpoint, I got to say that that's one thing that will improve the overall nature of everything is if everybody just got a little more, that's for sure.
they need physical. Do you know, this is when McGill University in Canada, 60 years ago, conducted these tests, and they found out that when animals give birth to a litter and they lick them, they're not cleaning them. They're touching them. And if they do not touch them, if this litter is taken away from the mother and not touched, they die. The skin is the largest organ on the body, and it must be touched.
Well, right.
It must be caressed, you know. Sex doesn't always mean penetration.
No, I'm not saying that at all. Even babies, human babies, If you ever check on some of these places where they're rehabilitating sickly children who are born addicted to drugs, who are abandoned, things like this, one of the most essential things that they have instructed the nurses to do in recent years, based on the good, solid research, is that they need to be picked up and held even as babies. In that developmental stage, it is thought actually that children would die, literally, if they were not touched or held at all.
Absolutely, and the smartest hospitals have designated holders. It's like you have a designated drunk driver, somebody who'll drive you home. Mothers who are not able to hold their infants for whatever reason, they have other women there designated to hold these children to keep them alive. So that's how important that is. But when I looked at this picture, it was the first time in years that I felt kind of sad. And the reason for that was because I lived through it, and I remember it so well. I mean, even the day he was shot, even though there were half the country literally hated John Kennedy, but the establishment half loved him, and the media loved him. So most of America didn't know how much John Kennedy was hated by the right-wing element in this society. And by the business owners in this society. As a matter of fact, one time, Pittsburgh Steel was thinking of raising the price of steel. And there were two other major steel companies. It looked like a price-fixing scandal.
Right. What happened there was U.S. Steel and the other companies, they were actually in the middle of a situation where they were arguing with their unions about raising wages. They got an agreement, supposedly, with Kennedy, and this is a kind of a, I'm trying to capsulize this whole story real quick, because I know where you're going. He turns around and makes an agreement with them. Listen, I'll get them to agree that you won't raise their wages, but that means that, you know, it's because you can't make your profit. Okay, I'm going to make that case with the union, and I'm going to end this, because there was actually a fairly crippling effect to the steel industry almost closing down due to the fact that there weren't going to be these workers that didn't want to work for these existing wages. They all wanted raises, basically.
Well, U.S. Steel was about to raise the price of steel in spite of the agreement Kennedy made. He called the guy up personally and said, if you raise it one nickel, the federal government is confiscating your company for the benefit of the society. Prices were never raised.
Right. That steel guy's name was Blau, by the way.
That's exactly right. B-L-O-U-G-H. You're absolutely right. So in any that, can you imagine what John Kennedy would have done to British Petroleum after what they did to the Gulf? He would have confiscated every single asset of that company and drained it to clean up the Gulf of Mexico. That's what he was done. Well, anyway, America did not know at the time how hated John Kennedy was by the business community, because the media flooded us with all these love letters and never told us anything about his peccadilloes, which was not really interesting anyway. But when I saw that picture of John Kennedy and Jackie, the reason I got sad, having lived through it, is I remember with what enthusiasm I look forward to the future because of the energy in the country, because of John Kennedy. Now when I look at that picture, I'm saddened because I'm forced to look at the past, at what we've lost. And I just don't ever like to look at the past. I mean, my past personal life was miserable enough, so I've tried to make light of it or ignore it or just move on. So that was the only time in the last 30 years I really feel bad. And it hurts me sometimes if I hear another speech of John Kennedy's, or I hear another speech of Jim Garrison's, or even, to me, the brightest man in America today is a guy named Chris Hedges, whose last speech, he said, the only recourse America has left is rebellion. And he's absolutely right. And if anybody wants to know how bright a man Chris Hedges is, just Google Chris Hedges' last speech on rebellion, and you will be you'll be floored at how brilliant and how right on the man is. So, in any event, that's difficult for me because, as I said, I do not like to look to the past, and I don't see a lot of hope for America or the world for the future, except that I know we're like massive cockroaches. No matter what's going to happen, bombs will fall and all the rest of it, and half of us will be deformed, but the species will survive. Somehow or another, mankind will survive. There's no way that you can get rid of it, even though they're trying to get rid of it.
Well, you know, to put it in context, too, I got to say that, you know, living in the time that I have lived, all I have seen really is a decline in enthusiasm, a decline in the positive, you know, sort of desire to look toward the future,
you
to
know,
have that optimism.
I hate to interrupt you, Chuck.
Sure.
That's true. And you know why? First of all, when Kennedy was alive and talking about doing things, he was exercising and jogging and playing golf, and he was bright as could be. I mean, he had about a dozen and a half Nobel laureates at the White House for dinner to one night, and when he addressed them, he said, "There hasn't been so much intellect in this room since Thomas Jefferson died and dined here alone." I mean, the guy was so bright and so witty, and he wrote his own books, for crying out loud. So a lot of people were infected by that enthusiasm on the national stage. None of that exists on America's national stage or media today whatsoever. I mean, who can you look at in high places and say, "I'd like to be like that," or "I hope my son or daughter grows up to be like that"? There are one or two isolated ones, but they're overcome by these cockroaches in our establishment, the people that own the country. And there's a great line from, it was a movie with Jack Nicholson called Easy Rider. Peter Fonda, Jack Nicholson, you remember the movie?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, there's a scene at night where Peter Fonda, God, I can't remember the other actor, and Jack Nicholson sitting around smoking a joint over a campfire. And Jack Nicholson is this young wannabe lawyer. He's smoking this joint. And he talks about what's wrong with people is they can't stand freedom. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with themselves. And you know that? That was in the 70s. That was true 40 years ago. And it's truer today. I mean, there's no one that we can look at and latch onto and think, "Gosh, I want to be like that. I'm going to work harder to be like that." You have to do it on your own. And if you're doing it on your own, it's really tough. It is tough to take control of your own life. That's one of the reasons I feel that a lot of fundamentalist religion is blossoming up around the world. There are more born-again Christians, and there are more devout Mormons, and there are more Latin Catholics, and there are more die-hard Muslims than ever before, because they're looking for something to help them get through the day, and that's not going to help. It just distracts them from their own responsibilities of taking their life in their own hands and being self-generating. And I must tell you, it is very, very difficult to do.
Oh, believe me, that's part of my daily sort of evolution that I'm working on. I mean, I'm still a work in progress myself, and I got to say that is exactly one of the toughest things. First, primarily, it is very difficult to get anyone to let loose some of these old dogmatic ways, whether it be religious, political, social. It's like they just seem to embrace their slavery sometimes. And in some ways, it is slavery on a psychological level, on a social level. You know, thinking for oneself is not in style right now. You know what I mean?
It's never been in style. Gee, I saw something on the Internet that I thought was really a terrific thought. and it had a nice picture up there, and it said, spirituality is having rapport or contact with the divine, whatever that divine is. Religion is crowd control. I mean, how smart is that?
That's absolutely brilliant, yeah.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, see, the Internet's good for a lot of stuff. If you filter it, it's good enough for a lot of stuff. Anyway, I'm going to tell you two showbiz stories again, if you don't mind. Because it'll show you how smart and so crafty some people can be to get ahead. You ever heard of a producer named David Susskind?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. When I was a kid, my very favorite talk show host, of course, was Jack Parr. Funny, witty, great conversationalist. But my favorite serious talk show host was David Susskind. And David Susskind became one of television's most famous, most applauded, and most honored television producers. He's in the Television Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Well, I had this wonderful, wonderful conversation with his son, and I put his son on camera to tell the story. And I don't know if I have the story up on my website or not, but I should put it up there because it's one of the greatest showbiz hustles that I've ever heard of. It goes back to the time when Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer was thinking of making the movie Ben-Hur, starring Charlton Heston. I'm sure you can remember the movie, and you can remember Chuck Heston from the National Rifle Association.
Of course.
Playing Moses and all the rest of it.
Right.
Anyway, David Susskind and his partner were these two struggling producers, even though David had this little talk show out of New York, and his partner's name was Al Levy. So Al Levy came into Susskind's office one day and puts down the Hollywood Reporter and the Daily Variety, and there are the headlines that MGM is announcing they're starting work on the biblical epic Ben-Hur. So Al says to David, "Dave, let's take out an ad or have a press release that we're going to do the television version of Ben-Hur." And David says, "What are you talking about? What about, you know, the rights?" And he says, "It's the Bible. Nobody has any rights to the Bible. It's public domain. Let's put out a press release." David says, "Oh, I don't know. Why?" "Never mind why. Let's just put out the press release and see what happens." So Susskind and Levy put out this press release that this small production company has a deal to start work for a network on the television version of Ben-Hur. So, the very moment that comes out, they get a call from Louis B. Mayer's office at Warner Brothers. "And the hell are you guys up to?" "Oh, nothing. We're just getting ready to do this work on the television version of Ben-Hur." And Mayer says, "Get your asses over here. I want to talk to you." So anyway, they go over to the offices, head offices in New York. And Mayer says, "What do you guys want?" And they said, "Nothing. We don't want anything." "No, no, you must want something. You guys are hustling me." "No, we're not hustling. Listen, we didn't even want the story to come out. I mean, we're already training horses. We're already training riders. We're building chariots." Mayer started screaming at them, "You're not doing that. How much do you want to stop this bullshit?" And they said, "It's not bullshit. We're really going to do it." He said, "Listen, I got a blank check here. How much do you want?" So Al Levy says, "Mr. Mayer, we don't want anything." And Mayer says, "What do you mean you don't want anything? I mean, what do you want to stop this bullshit?" "We don't want anything. You're going to stop it?" "Well, it's some money we want." "Well, what is it you want?" So Al Levy says, David and I would like to have the television rights to all the MGM music classics. So without missing a beat, Mayer says, you got it. It's a deal. And on that handshake, he turned over all the classic movies that MGM made so that David and Al Levy could do the television versions. And that included all of them. And that's how they became successful television producers.
Just by suckering them in with that ad.
Just suckered them in with that ad. That's how... I mean, the town is full of those kind of hustles. But the thing was that it was a hustle. It paid off because their television versions of the movies were every bit as good as the film versions, because David was smart enough to hire really good writers and really good directors to perform the material. Now, the last showbiz story that I'm going to tell you is about Red Fox. Red Fox became my mentor when I first was starting in this business. And my wife was the one who talked me into going down to see Red, because when she was singing with Earl Hines in San Francisco, she befriended not only Red Fox, but Dick Gregory. Dick Gregory was the very first black comic who talked like Mort Sahl and Bob Hope about political and topical subject, and became an instant star overnight. He was the biggest black entertainer for 2 or 3 years. And that was just on an accidental appearance at the Playboy Club. Another act was scheduled to perform at the Playboy Club and couldn't make it, and they called Dick, and it was some kind of convention, and they were only paying him $50. Well, a stringer for Time magazine happened to be in the audience when Dick performed and wrote a one-paragraph review of this topical black comedian, and the next day he was a star. That's how powerful Time magazine was at the time. Anyway, I became really good friends with Red and knew him all his life.
Just as a brief aside, John.
Sure.
For those in my audience who aren't aware of Dick Gregory, he made a lot of significantly controversial statements during his career, and I think he's definitely somebody who's certainly worth a Google search. And even you can find him active among the JFK assassination people at one point, and was actually present the night that Geraldo aired the Zapruder film for the first time to the American public.
That's right, and he and Mark Lane co-authored a great book. It was originally called Codename Zorro. It's been renamed Murder in Memphis. It's about the government's and the FBI's murder of Martin Luther King, and it's a fabulous, fabulous book. But this was long before he ever did that.
Right.
I mean, long before he had a beard. If they're going to Google him, Google Dick Gregory's stand-up or monologues, and see how absolutely charming and bright and funny he was. And, of course, he took it a step further, is that he got involved in civil rights. He got involved in politics. So he went from being a stand-up comedian to being a social and political activist, thankfully, for the benefit of the country. But in any event, Red was an extreme, next to Jackie Mason, Red Fox was by far the wittiest person ad lib that I had ever met. And Red had about 20 successful party records. They were dirty, but they were funny. And
oh, I absolutely loved those.
Oh.
I got to tell you, some of the best ones, since you mentioned he was an ad libber, some of the best ones that I ever heard was when audience members would turn around and try and, like, mess with him a little bit on stage. And he was the first guy I ever heard who was doing a stand-up routine to absolutely, like, just shut a guy down who was heckling him. And he was amazingly, like, really witty, thought well on his...
Oh, he was brilliant. Yeah. I remember one night I saw him in the Slate Brothers Club, which is in La Cienega in in Los Angeles at the time. As a matter of fact, that was his favorite place to perform to white folks. And then when he got Sanford, he eventually bought it. But one night, I was in the crowd, and some guy in the back hollers out, "Why don't you go back where you came from?" And the place got really quiet. And Red looked at him and said, "Under no conditions is I going back to St. Louis." Well, the audience erupted because that's where he came from, was St. Louis. I mean, it was terrific. Nobody could top Red Fox under any circumstances. But in any event, he was, and I had gotten an idea for doing an album at the time. It was in the mid-60s, and the concept was called "It's Tough to Be White." Did I mention this to you the last time I talked to you?
No, not this story, no.
Oh, okay. Well, in any event, the reason the story came about, I mean, aside from the fact that the whole world was falling apart with the civil rights movement going on, you know, and the opening line of my act was being brought to you by the NAACP, and the audience would chuckle, and they'd say, "The National Association for the Advancement of Canadian People." That's where I did. And so my act consisted of my observations of the United States as a new arrival here. In any event, on one of David Susskind's open-end shows, they had a Jew who had served 22 years in prison for a crime he had not committed. They had a black guy who had served 9 years in prison for a crime he had not committed. And a very famous civil libertarian lawyer named Jake Ehrlich, who was very famous in law circles and in bar rooms. He was always totally drunk most of the time. Anyway, David Susskind, as would be his wont, seems to take more interest in what happened to the black guy than to the fellow Jew that served 22 years for a crime he didn't commit. And so David looks at the black guy and then looks over at Jake Ehrlich, and he says to Jake, "How is it in America that the man like this could serve 9 years for a crime he didn't commit?" Like the weeping liberal that he was. So
right.
Jake gathers himself up like he's going to say something really important, as most lawyers think they're going to do. And he says, "Well, David, look at him. The guy is black. And you know, in America, when they arrest the black, he doesn't stand a Chinaman's chance." And all of them, none of them reacted. They didn't realize what Ehrlich had said. Well, I'm on the floor screaming, and I thought, "Oh my God, it's tough to be white," I said to my wife. So I thought, "My God, what a great idea." So I wrote this material on "It's Tough to Be White." And I went down to the Slate Brothers where Red was performing. And after the show, we came outside and he says, "What is it?" And I said, "Well, Red, I have this idea for some material. And I want to call the album 'It's Tough to Be White.'" And he giggled. He said, I like that. And he said, "Let's hear." So I gave him some of the lines and he loved it. So I said, "But Red, I don't want people to think that I'm a bigot." And as smart and as wise as this guy is, he says, "Shit, man, make it first and then explain." So I thought, God, anyway, he set it up with World Pacific Jazz to make the album. We make the album. Anyway, I don't want to go into, I tell you more stories about how I tried to, they booked me into the Playboy Club, and then they didn't want me to do the album because the riots came. And then to prove that it was going to be successful, I had Ebony Magazine book me into the California Club in the heart of Watts 2 weeks after the riots. And I was an absolute smash to that. And you know what? In the front of a black audience, if they don't like you, they let you know right away. So they're talking to you during your act. So you better know what it is you were doing. It was the first and only standing ovation I ever got when I was done. And Ebony Magazine, who said they were going to do the story about this guy who was doing this album, backed off because they thought it would be too controversial. I couldn't believe it. I mean, they booked me into the Playboy Club, which is supposed to be progressive, and then they don't want me to do the material. Anyway, It went bye-bye. And I was eventually assigned as Merv Griffin's replacement, and they hired this David Frost Englishman. And so Channel 11 in Los Angeles hired me because they thought that the Englishman wasn't going to make it. And they were right. He didn't make it as predicted. And I was going to be sort of a backup, sort of a poor man's Johnny Carson. And I had this show on a Saturday night, one night a week. And I decided I was going to book Red Fox. And they were terrified. Because what I had done is I'd gone to a couple of stations because I always wanted to be like Jack Parr. And Jack Parr had Hugh Downs. Johnny Carson had Ed McMahon. So I went to a few stations and I said, I would love Red Fox to be my Ed McMahon. And they wouldn't put me on the air. I was unknown and certainly weren't going to put an older black guy on the air, even though Arthur Treacher must have been 80 when he was Merv Griffin's sidekick. So I was going to book Red. Now, the only person in America who ever talked to him at all was Hugh Downs, who interviewed him very briefly on the Today Show. But it was only like a minute and a half interview. And I was going to have Red on 10, 15, 20 minutes, as long as he wanted to be on. The story I'm going to tell you is the biggest laugh ever heard in a television studio by an ad lib. Now, my guests that night were, who was the coochie coochie girl who played the guitar?
Charo.
Charo was the girl singer, a crying comedian. His name was Rick Taylor, the crying comedian. Jack Carter, the comedian. The Red Fox.
Rick Taylor, like the guy who threw the confetti around, that guy?
Yeah, that's the guy. Okay. And Red Fox. And I knew everything about Red Zach, so I wanted to be able to set him up comfortably. So when he came out there, one of the questions I asked him was how he felt about the Black Power movement in the country, and did he support it? And he says, I don't support white power, and I don't support black power. He says, I support green power, because if you have green, you buy the places where the blacks and the whites hold their meetings. Well, the audience chuckled. And I don't know why I said this, because I wanted him to go into his act, but it just occurred to me, why is money green? So I said, turn to Red. And it was a total ad lib on my part. And I said, Red, why do you think money's colored green? And without missing a beat, he says, that's because Jews pick it before it gets ripe.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God. There was thunder in the audience. I mean, people were falling over. They'd never heard anything like this in their lives. We could not continue the show. The panel, which was two more comedians and Charo, they were screaming and pounding the chairs. And, oh, my God, it was absolute bedlam. And then whenever it was going to die down, Jack Carter would jump up and pull money out of his pocket. And he says, I picked it before it got ripe. And it would start all over again. There has never been a laugh in television that big ever. I mean,
and you know, if that happened today, you'd probably be part of a media tour where you'd spend the next 2 weeks apologizing for it.
Oh,
you know,
yes. Listen, they would edit it. They would never let it come out. They would edit it. They wouldn't even air it, for crying out loud. Supposedly, one of the biggest laughs in television was when Johnny Carson threw a tomahawk at one of the singer that used to play some Indian on a television show and almost hit him in the crotch. It was a big laugh, and it was funny. But nothing compared to what happened in my studio that night. It was just absolutely, absolutely bedlam. So anyway, that's that particular story. And
it's definitely an amazing snapshot of the difference in times and really a look at some of these people that are iconic images to us at this point. I mean, Red Fox, I mean, everybody remembers Sanford and Son. But
that's his real name, by the way. His real name was John Sanford. and the son was named after his big brother who died when he was in his 40s. Red was, the sad thing about Red was that success went to his nose. I mean, he always smoked joints, and that's fine. I've never taken, you know, I don't even drink. I have a glass, one glass of wine at dinner, and that's it. I don't drink anything at all. I don't smoke cigarettes. And as a matter of fact, I used to, and it based on a true story, is when I was about 11 years of age, I used to tell this to the audience. When I was 11, I stole this, and I said, I don't smoke. And the reason I don't smoke is when I was 11, went into this little confectionery store in Kingston Boulevard in Toronto, Kingston Road, and I stole this carton of cigarettes. And I was so scared. I smoked one, and what was I going to do with all the others? So I had to hide all the evidence. So I smoked and spent the entire afternoon smoking an entire carton, and I got sick, and I was throwing up. So I never smoked again. And then I said, I don't drink either, you know. Mm-hmm. I said, because a couple of months after that, I went back into the same place, and I stole a six-pack of beer, and then I had to hide the evidence, and I drank all six bottles, and spent the rest of the afternoon urinating all over the neighborhood, so that's why I don't drink anymore. And then, about 3 months after that, I snuck into the same store, and I stole a dozen condoms, and then I would pull out of my pocket. I say, I have one left. So in any event, but Red sadly had this terrible coke habit. A couple of times he had to go to the hospital for deviated septum and stuff like that.
Yeah, I have heard those stories over the years, and I find that stuff very sad because he was really a brilliant man, and it was. It as happens a lot of times with performers, artists of all kinds, they tend to indulge in things like that sometimes, and does destroy them way too early.
You know who one of his best friends was? Malcolm X.
No kidding.
Yeah, they were in jail together. They were the best of friends for the longest of times. But Malcolm grew. You know, Malcolm grew from just being a blacks-only person. He went to Mecca. Actually came back from Mecca and changed his entire philosophy. He felt that the world could and should be integrated.
That was the point at which he actually
became estranged with Elijah Muhammad. You know?
From Elijah Muhammad, right, and actually founded a separate version of the Nation of Islam, which was, there was a separate corporation and everything for it.
Yes, but I'm inclined to believe Dick Gregory's version of the murder of Malcolm X, that it was the CIA and how they did it. And I think if you Google that, you can hear him explain it. It sounds really outlandish at times, but it would not surprise me at all because I see no reason why Elijah Muhammad would have Malcolm X murdered because he wasn't about to lose much of his congregation to Malcolm X. So,
well,
the thing is that he was a threat to the military establishment, as was Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, a year before he was assassinated, said at the Riverside Church in New York that, I hate to say this, but the largest terrorist organization in the world is the United States government and the Pentagon. And he said, I don't like to say that about my own country. But he said it, and they knew they had to get rid of him. And they did.
It's an absolute truth that anybody that that ever stands up to the military-industrial intelligence complex. Wow, I couldn't get that word out.
Yeah, and you know, somebody else I miss Bill Hicks. I think Bill was 32 when he died, and if you Google Bill Hicks, he was a funnier version of George Carlin. And George was very funny, and George has a way with words unlike any comedian who ever lived. I mean, his control and command of the language and how to put sentences together was unequaled. but I found him often more interesting than he was funny.
Well, John, I'm sorry.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
But I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
In the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
yeah,
that guy
how is that possible for him? You know,
the choice,
and I'm knowing that's what I'm doing. Internet,
yeah, okay.
Professional
wrestlers,
and not just
Jesse Ventura style.
It doesn't matter
what
information they want, as long as it's real.
It doesn't,
it's hard to get real information. Because
seriously,
information is real.